While everyone's talking about AI replacing people, smart companies know the real opportunity is using AI to make their people better. Lattice is the HR platform where people and AI succeed together, helping every employee grow, every manager lead, and every company achieve greater success. Let's build a people-powered future. No regrets. Visit lattice.com/no regrets. That's LATTICE.com/no regrets.
Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. I'm Sonny Bunch, culture editor at The Bulwark. I'm very pleased to be joined today by Farron Smith-Nemme. Farron has written about film and film history for Criterion, Film Comments, Sight and Sound, The Wall Street Journal, and numerous other outlets. In 2014, she published a novel, Missing Reels, and these days she can be found at her new Substack, Self-Styled Siren. I'll have a link to that in the newsletter. Make sure you check it out. Sign up. But what we are talking about today is a very exciting and very special new feature on the greatest release of the greatest film of all time, Citizen Kane on 4K UHD for the Criterion Collection. Has a big, huge new set out now. It has literally, I mean, you could spend 3 or 4 work days just going through all of the extras on this, the commentary tracks, multiple commentary tracks. There's a BBC documentary that is essentially as long as the film itself almost. I mean, it is a massive set. It's an entire semester of Citizen Kane knowledge on one collection. But I wanted to talk to you about your interview, the interview that you do on the disc, because I think it's really interesting to help understand how the film came into existence and the challenges it faced upon both making it and upon release. It's a really interesting little business of Hollywood backstory, and I want to fill folks in on this. So thank you for being on the show, Farron. I really appreciate it.
I'm glad to be here.
So let's talk about how the origin of Citizen Kane. Right. What was the impetus of this? How did Orson Welles and Mr. Mankiewicz come up with this movie and get it rolling?
Well, I mean, I think that Herman Mankiewicz had kind of wanted to write about like a press baron for a long time, and Orson Welles had been in Hollywood already for a while, and they were batting around different suggestions, and I think they hit on this notion of writing an American story, and thought, you know, that this was going to be good, because there were a lot of really colorful businessmen around this time, and they did pretty much latch on to William Randolph Hearst as like a primary inspiration. But you know, one thing I discovered when I was doing research was that he was by no means the only one. Imagine my surprise to discover that there was this weird kind of trend at the time for magnates to go out and try and make their wives into opera stars. One guy actually built the Chicago Opera House for his wife, and there was another one who just spent years and none of them were particularly good singers, and it was this strange kind of thing that I think they kind of welded to a disguised version of Hearst and Marion Davies, unfortunately somewhat to Davies' detriment, which, you know, was something we discussed.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about that, because this is I know it's a subcurrent in some of the films that have been made about Citizen Kane, for instance Mank and RKO 281, that Davies kind of is treated unfairly by the assumption that this is a pure Hearst biopic.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I think they both claimed, and I think to a certain extent they really were this naive, that, you know, they thought that the fact that Susan is flagrantly untalented was going to be a big tell, you know, to people that this was not really Marion Davies, right? But that's not what happened. I guess at the time this film was made, Davies was retired. So she wasn't as familiar to audiences. It wasn't nowadays where, you know, or even like the 70s and 80s when I grew up, when you'd flick on the TV and see like old movies. Once your movies were out of circulation, your, you know, image was too. And so I think it was easy for people, you know, who didn't know any better to kind of assume that this was, you know, that she was like Susan, you know.
Yeah.
Screechy, yeah. And annoying, and talent free and somewhat selfish. And all of these were qualities that, you know, did not describe Marion Davies really at all. That wasn't what she was like. She was, by most accounts, delightful company. You know, I don't think anybody would say that about Susan Alexander, possibly not even Kane. But,
yeah, I it's interesting to listen to you talk about the efforts to advertise the movie, because of course, you know, Hearst owns a large number of the newspapers and other media outlets in America. He has a fair amount of control of what people can see. How was it? How did he kind of try to mute the reaction to it and the ability of folks to actually know that the movie was coming out?
Well, he tried a lot of different things. Like for a while, he was trying to tag Wells as a communist. And this was, it was so obvious, that particular maneuver, that in some of the other papers, particularly the left-wing ones, you know, they were like, oh, look, William Randolph Hearst is trying to call Orson Welles a communist. Everybody knew, like, what it was about. The one thing you will not find in the non-Hearst press is real, at least as far as I can tell, is real references to his affair with Marion Davies. That was the third rail. You didn't go there. I found like at least a couple of fan magazines that if you were in the know, it was like dropping a cinder block on your head in terms of hints. You know, they were like, oh, and he took his entire, and we do mean his entire entourage on a picnic. You know, like you were supposed to know that meant Marion. But for the most part, they wouldn't refer to that. So anyway, you know, the whole communist angle kind of didn't go anywhere. And what Hearst lit on and was, I think it eventually quite harmful. He decided to give it the silent treatment. I would go into newspapers from that era, and a Hearst newspaper would have, let's say, the Rialto down the street is playing Citizen Kane, and they would have listings for movies. But what it would say for the Rialto is it would just say feature presentation, you know, and then it might tell you the second feature or something. But they wouldn't even put the name of the movie in such listings, let alone like run ads for it or anything like that. So even though Hearst's newspaper holdings had diminished at that point, they were still considerable. So this was a sizable chunk of American newspapers that weren't telling you about this movie. And that was damaging.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting, because when I, a couple weeks ago, I talked to Will Haygood, who has a new history of African-American cinema out, and one of the things that keeps recurring in that book is controversy leads to more sales. So, you know, controversy of Birth of a Nation leads to more sales, but also controversy of Sweetback's Badass Song also leads to more sales. I mean, it's a really interesting, but the silent treatment does have an effect, I think, more so than just about anything else you can do. So the movie does come out, and it is a modest, you know, success critically and slightly less so commercially, I think is fair to say. But, you know, I really enjoyed hearing you talk about the fact that this movie is not like some lost rediscovered classic, right? It, from the beginning, it was recognized as one of the great, works, and how has that kind of played through the years?
Well, I mean, I think from the beginning, when they screened a rough cut for some Hollywood producers, because there was talk of trying to buy the negative from RKO and just destroying it. L.B. Mayer, I believe, was one of the people who was offering to chip in the money. And so RKO arranged for this screening, and it was industry insiders. And it was held in New York. You know, they flew out, and they said the reaction was just, you know, like stunned appreciation. You know, the people in the industry knew what it was. They recognized its quality. They saw, you know, how revolutionary a lot of what Wells was doing was. You know, maybe not the first, in fact, frequently not the first film to have done certain things, but the way all of these techniques and all of these narrative devices were wrapped up into this one movie was truly impressive. So I think it was not something that had to be discovered, you know, by cinephiles later on as a lost masterpiece. And I think it started being fairly successful in re-release, even like some years later. Eventually was being shown on television and stuff, but I guess it was the Sight and Sound poll that really sort of cemented its reputation.
Right, so it's topping the polls. Everybody loves it, and it is well recognized. I think everybody at this point will more or less agree, except for the random people who will occasionally say Citizen Kane is so boring, and I want to throttle them, because even if you are to say, all right, look, I can't recognize the innovations in this because I'm so used to them and it's become so ingrained in film language. It's still just a fascinating story, right? I mean, yeah. It's crazy.
I mean, I find it endlessly fascinating. And I think the first time I saw it, I was probably 10 or 11 years old. And my father told me to watch it. He said, it's a really good movie. It's about a guy who owns newspapers or something like that. So I watched it like that. And I think that was a gift, watching it without all the baggage. When Vertigo toppled Citizen Kane in this last, I guess that was 2012. We've got another one coming up for the Sight and Sound poll. When Vertigo toppled it, I was not kidding when I said on my blog, I'm glad, you know, let people say Vertigo is boring. which it's not. Vertigo is also a complete masterpiece. Let me be clear there. But I'm like, yeah, let you know, people can aim their pea shooters at a different movie for a while, and give Citizen Kane a break, because I do think it's a marvelously entertaining movie. And people who say it's boring, I think, are people who are not used to the rhythms of movies from that era, who maybe don't watch that kind of somber adult drama very often anyway. And probably don't appreciate the dialogue. It's, or maybe they just haven't sat down to watch it with somebody like you or me.
You say it's a somber adult drama, and there is seriousness to it, certainly, but it's also remarkably funny. I mean,
it is. Yeah,
Wells himself is magnetic on screen and amusing to watch. I'm preaching to the choir here. We don't have to talk about how great Citizen Kane is. An interesting thing about Citizen Kane is how much, and this is, I am sure, an artifact of its popularity and its critical acclaim and all that, but there is so much argument and debate over who deserves credit for what goes into who should be considered the true author of it, you know, whatever. And going all the way back to, you know, Pauline Kael and her book length essentially case for Herman Mankiewicz all the way up to Mank again last year from Netflix. Like, what do you make of this as a historian and as a researcher? I mean, as you're looking through some of these original source materials, what do you make of the kind of the conflicts here between the two different sides, or all the different sides, frankly?
I mean, Robert Carringer went back through like the records at RKO and script records and things, and I think proved quite definitively that that Orson Welles had a great deal of input into the screenplay. When Mankiewicz finished his first draft, it was, Christ, like 200 pages. It was just, you know, incredibly long, and had a lot of stuff that they wound up tossing out. You know, it had to be pared and sharpened, and that a lot of that was Orson Welles' contribution. You know, he sort of took the raw materials, and then, you know, there was more back and forth. I think that the Mankiewicz partisans, and particularly Cale, was reacting to the notion that he had nothing to do with it. You know, leaving him out of the story was immensely irritating to them, for good reason. He did contribute a great deal, and there are people besides Orson Welles who contributed a lot to the movie. It would not be the same movie if it had not been lensed by Greg Tolland, you know. Welles learned a lot from him in terms of how the movie was put together. You know, it's editing, it's the performances, right? They are, you know, uniformly superb. But if you're looking at Citizen Kane, you have to keep coming back to Orson Welles because he is the backstop to all of it, right? He was the final word on the screenplay. He was the one who, you know, said, who envisioned like one shot, you know, that was going to be from really low down, and he couldn't get it low enough down, so he cut a hole in the damn floor. That was Welles. Even John Houseman, who in later years had a major ongoing feud with Welles, said, you know, well, it's Welles's movie. You can't disconnect it from him. You can't take it away. I don't know why anyone would want to.
Yeah.
Unless you're related to, you know, like somebody.
If you're not a Mankiewicz, yeah, why are you? Anyway. But yeah, no, I mean, it's a great set. People should go out there and buy it. I am, as folks who listen know, a partisan of physical media for a variety of reasons, and Criterion in particular, because they are, they do such a good job with the presentation, not just of, you know, packaging and the actual transfer of the disc, but all of the extras on the disc. And one of my favorite, I mentioned this to you when we were communicating, but one of my favorite is the video essay that you did for the Whit Stillman collection that came out a couple years back. I'm tremendously fond of that series of films, and that bit in particular. What was it about? I want to take it a step back. When you work on something like this for Criterion, do they come to you and say, "Hey, we would like you to do this," or do you pitch them on things? Or is there like a master list of like forthcoming movies, and they're like, "Who wants to do something on these movies?" I'm curious how that all works.
No, I don't pitch them. Not for the physical releases, and not for the channel either. You know, you could conceivably pitch them for the Current, you know, their website. No, they put it together. You know, they have producers whose job it is, you know, to envision what's going to go into the release, and they decide, you know, who they're going to ask to do what. Yeah. And so it also depends on people's availability. Sometimes people can't do something or whatever. So I was asked to do the Whit Stillman video, and I was really happy about it because I love his films. I think that the producer on that one might have seen my rave review for Damsels in Distress, and you know, figured I was in tune with his sensibility. So
Yeah. When you're putting together a video essay like that, is it do you write first or pick video clips first? I do not work in video really at all. I'm a writer almost exclusively. So I'm curious what the process on that is. I mean, is it
it can, they give you a lot of freedom. You know, they tell you, you know, what they would like for a video like that, or for the one I did with the Irishman. You know, they'll give you like the outlines of the idea, you know, and maybe if they really want it to include this or that, they might mention that. But otherwise, you have a fair amount of freedom. You know, they're hiring you for your knowledge and creativity. So with the Whit Stillman films, I went back and I watched them one by one. I did the same thing for the Irishman, and like the gangster movies of Scorsese. And I just, you know, took notes, did some thinking, and then I started writing. And so then after that, it was sort of a little of both, a little of going to the movie and saying, oh, I want to talk about this move, this moment. And also a little of thinking, I want to make this point, what would be a good way to illustrate it? You don't necessarily have to go through and piece by piece tell them exactly which parts of the movie you want them to include. Their editors are total wizards, a lot of times they'll come up with things I never would have thought of, but it's perfect, right? Mm-hmm. And you want to, at least I wanted to give them some freedom to do that. But if you had seen like the Whit Stillman script, you would have seen that I did have a number of notations about things, you know, where what clips I thought could be used at which point, or sometimes that's just the scene I'm talking about.
Sure. Yeah, that's really interesting. Like I said, that is on the, I think it's on the Last Days of Disco disc. Is that right?
It's on
Barcelona. I can't remember.
it's on the 3-disc set. Doom Bourgeois in Love might be
there's a trilogy, a Blu-ray trilogy that you can pick up. It is on one of those discs, very much worth watching. Let's talk a little bit about your you just started a Substack, which is a resurrection of your old blog, Self-Styled Siren. Sell it to the people. Give the people the elevator pitch
of the
Substack. I don't mean to put you on the spot, but it's a really interesting look at older movies, and I don't want to do it injustice.
Well, I mean, if someone who is listening to this really wanted to see like what I have in mind and what it's going to be like, they could go back and look at the old blog, right? Because I really kind of envision it as a continuation of that. I have some more time to write things on my own. And what the blog was always great for was just writing things that nobody in their right mind was going to have space or time or, you know, like the ability to run it in a real, on a paying website or a magazine. Sure. Or whatever. That's the freedom that you have. It's the freedom you used to have from a blog, and now it's the freedom you can have from Patreon or Substack or whatever your chosen thing is. So yeah, if you look at the blog and you see the kind of things I wrote, and then you see like I've only got a couple of full-fledged posts on the Substack, but this is, you know, how I envision it going.
Yeah. One of the first was a breakdown of the number of adults films, you know, films for adults, to clarify, as opposed to comic book movies, et cetera, as a way to kind of push back against the superhero movies or just the Westerns of modern times. It is not a similar thing really at all. But what is the focus? What is the focus of the Substack? What sort of, what era, what sort of movies are you looking at mostly?
In general, I tend to write about pre-1960 film. And when I was on Twitter a while back, Robert Kohler, the critic and programmer, was asking, he was like, well, you know, 1960, I'm interested in that. Is that because, you know, that was really like when the new wave started coming in and everything changed? And I was like, no, it was really a little more arbitrary than that. It's just that most of my favorite films are like the 1920s through like 1960 or so. I have certainly watched and enjoyed earlier silence, like pre-1920 silence, but that's it's not a specialty. It's not something I, you know, feel confident about opining on, but the other decades I do enjoy and do feel like I know something about and have something to say about them. So that's kind of the reason why that's there. But I have written about movies in the 60s. I love a lot of the new wave stuff and a lot of the 1960 stuff. I love a lot of 1970s movies, and I've written about them and probably will continue to do so. I have to say that once we start getting to the 1980s, the pickings get slimmer for me, you know. You know, again, that's not to say that that's, you know, all she wrote. The Stillman, you know, started making movies in what, 1990, I think, was Metropolitan.
Metropolitan was 90. Like I said, I'll link to the Substack in there, but I love the idea of continuation of blogs into the world of Substacks, because I feel like the loss of blogs that we have kind of gone through over the last 10 years has been bad for a lot of things, discourse, that sort of stuff, but also just like knowledge. I think there were a number of very interesting and very well done blogs that, you know, could not really be replicated in full on paying publications and have a nice space on Substack. I'm biased, of course, because this podcast is hosted on Substack, and you know, we do stuff there. But I think it is actually a net positive on the whole.
Well, it's also a net positive in that I don't know if people even remember this, but when I joined Twitter like in 2009, it was billed as a micro blogging service, right? So you were doing your, you know, it was only 180 characters then. Sure. You were doing like your, and that was supposed to, you know, replace or in any event supplement blogging. Right. And I think we all discovered very quickly that it's really not comparable. No. You can be calm and reasoned and well supported in the course of a blog post in a way that you really cannot be on Twitter. And I think as much as I enjoy Twitter, it's also fragmented, attention spans even more. I used to say that I didn't like to write blog posts past 2,000 words. Both of my Substack posts, incidentally, are well past 2,000 words. But that's, but when I was blogging, I was like, I don't want to go much, because I think people just quit reading, right?
Yeah.
And I think that was true then. And then you get to Twitter, and I am repeatedly reminded that people often can't be bothered to read all the way to the end of the tweet, you know, or to look down to what you're quote tweeting. So I'm hoping that Substack and Patreon and Medium and some of these other platforms will give people more of an opportunity to do what they were doing with blogs and just, you know, slow down, be a little more thoughtful.
Yeah, I think that would be best for everyone. Well, that was everything I wanted to ask, Farron. Was there anything else you think people should know about Citizen Kane, about the Criterion Collection, about your Substack, anything? I mean, I always like to close these by asking what I should have asked. So what would you like the folks to know?
Well, I mean, I wanted to say that I see myself, in terms of writing about old movies, I see myself as an evangelist and not a scold, as as sort of impatient as I get with dislike for Citizen Kane, in the end, what I really want to do is get people to sort of explore the vast reaches of this art form that, you know, our country has contributed to so significantly. And then, you know, and God knows all of the other countries around the world that have, you know, brilliant, amazing cinema that stretches back into the silent era as well. So in my heart, I'm convinced that if you think you don't like old movies, if you think you don't like black and white movies, you haven't found the right one. You haven't found the one that's going to make the penny drop. People have notions of what old movies are, and I think they don't realize the incredible variety of movies that are out there, right? Like, for example, I was reading today about a movie called Big House USA. I think it's like from 1955. And it, you know, it breaks a taboo, like in its first 20 minutes, that you still don't see broken that often in movies. And this is a 1955 movie. And then later on, it gets into some really, you know, like strong violence, even though it's not shown. It's 1955 and it's black and white. And it's just a very harsh movie with very unlikable characters. I'm sure Quentin Tarantino loves this movie because it stars Ralph Meeker, and he is all about Ralph Meeker. But that's just one example. I feel like when I see people saying, oh, well, you know, I'm just not into it, you know, like, just wait, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is one of the great things about the Criterion Channel as well, is that they have a very nicely curated selection that kind of rotates through not only of their own titles, but other classic films. I mean, I went through when the Columbia Noir series dropped, I went through, I don't know, half that set, just filling in gaps and watching, and like, oh, I like those actors. I like this. It was great. I would show that to anyone.
It was so popular that, like, I did an intro for that with my friend Imogen Smith. They filmed us separately, and we were talking about like the genesis of Columbia Noir, what the visual style was like and things of that nature. And that series was just, it was wildly popular. Noir is a style that really appeals to like the modern mindset. You know, I think like the fatalism, the notion that the system is rigged or whatever, people hone in on that quite well. But I mean, with the channel, I would just advise people to, you know, noodle around with it. It's got a beautifully set up front page with all of those series and things. It's very easy to just kind of hang out there. But in one night when you're bored, just start searching keywords. You will find things like sort of on the back shelves that are amazing that you had no idea were there.
Yeah. Yeah, that would my only real advice for the Criterion Channel, not that they've asked, but would be to make that browsing just a slight bit easier. Like make it a little more user friendly to get in there and just kind of like really go through the whole library. But it's a great channel. People should definitely check it out if they have not already. Farron, thank you very much for being on the show. I really appreciate it. Once again, everybody go sign up for a Substack. Link is in the letter, and go pick up that Criterion 4K set. I mean, even if you don't need the image upgrade from your DVD or your Blu-ray, you do need all of that stuff that's on. Again, it's days of material to go through. So check it out. And I will be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. See you guys then.